As Chief Justice Gilbertson is participating by telephone, he is designated the Honorable Richard W. Sabres as presiding justice in the courtroom.
Good morning again. In this case, Justice Conan Camp is disqualified, and we have the Honorable John Erickson from Huron sitting in for him. And as our clerk has noted, Justice Gilbertson is on communications with us. This is the case of Travis Daniels versus Douglas Kettering. Mr. Robin Zephyr for the plaintiff and appellant, and Mr. Ronald Kapperman for the defendant and appellee. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Justices. Good morning, Justice Chief Justice Gilbertson.
Good morning.
Mr. Kapperman. Madam Clerk. Again, Justices, it is a privilege to appear before this honorable court on a matter of important concern. This is not a matter that is specifically important to my client, Mr. Daniels, but I believe many of the issues in this case are also important to litigants throughout the state of South Dakota. In this case, my client, the appellant, Travis Daniels, a young, hardworking father, husband, and son, unfortunately dealt with an unforeseen event occurring on April 8th of 1998 in Rapid City, which caused a major interruption in his life and that of his family. I'm here today, Justices, with the honor and privilege of expressing important issues on Mr. Daniels' behalf before this honorable court. I do not profess to be the smartest or the brightest lawyer, nor would I ever, although I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night. But I, however, will try to inform the court the best of my ability and answer the court's question as I can. I believe the factual background of the case was well briefed by both sides. Our primary purpose in filing this appeal, however, I will share with the justices, is seeking a revision of the concepts of fairness and justice, and is to seek out mainly a new trial for Mr. Daniels under the circumstances. We honestly believe that the first four issues in the appeal are predominant, in that the trial court's rulings prior to and at the time of the trial had an impact on what the jury was allowed to hear and when. With the exception of issue one, which we place solely upon the shoulders and minds of this particular jury, the trial court's rulings on issues two, three, and four, we believe, denied Mr. Daniels the right to a fair, unbiased, unprejudiced, and reasonable jury trial and verdict determination. With that in mind, Justices, I would first of all like to address issue one. We briefed this, and I will not bore the court with mundane facts and repeated analysis, but within the brief, we did express matters of evidence that were presented before the trial court and the jury. In this particular case, there was an admitted negligence by the defendant. Unfortunately, the initial defendant had died during the pendency of the action, and Mr. Kettering, a relative and a special administrator, was appointed in his stead. In that respect, the evidence presented at trial particularly focused upon Mr. Daniels' damages. There were a number of witnesses that testified on his behalf, including three physicians, forensic economist, vocational rehabilitation expert, and many eyewitnesses and fact witnesses. The defendant did bring forth an IME expert in defense of the damages claim made by Mr. Daniels, as well as a private investigator. Those individuals did testify on behalf of the defense. There was much video trial deposition testimony that was presented in front of the jury. Issue one is an important issue in respect that this was a case which provided overwhelming evidence of significant injury to Mr. Daniels. And even the expert that was employed by the defendant in this case acknowledged that if Mr. Daniels' right shoulder injury were not to be fully caused by the April 8, 1998 mechanism of injury, then at least in respect to a percentage, two-thirds of it was. And that's cited within my brief and within the testimony of the trial deposition of their expert. I think the this particular issue is basically joined in and somewhat merges with issue number four, which is the matter involving the surveillance tapes. Justices, the law in South Dakota on the issue of surveillance tapes, I believe, does not provide us with any clear analysis on point. However, there are many authorities within the cases cited within our brief on the appellant side that should provide guidance to this court in examining the review that you must to determine whether or not my client deserves a new trial, one that is fair, unbiased, and unprejudiced by the introduction of those particular surveillance tapes. I apologize if I jump around, but I'm trying to show how those two issues are basically joined at the hip. When those surveillance tapes were introduced, they were introduced for the purpose, from our perspective, to show Mr. Daniels participating in conduct and activities where he's raising his arms over his head.
Mr. Daniels, you were bushwhacked by the introduction of these tapes?
No, Justice, I am not claiming that. Those were provided to us in a timely fashion, and we are not raising that as an issue.
Right.
However, those tapes in particular were exhibited and through a private investigator, Mr. Schnell, we believe for the sole purpose of creating a passion and prejudice in the jurors against my client, Mr. Daniels. Mr. Daniels did not testify any point that he could never raise his arms over his head or participate in activities of that nature, whether it be hobbies, sporting activities, or on the job. These particular videos are approximately 42 minutes in length, most of which was from August of 1998, which was approximately several months after the accident, and then approximately 3 years later. However, the video footage in particular shows Mr. Daniels participating in activities at his work site, and they're taken from a distance, and there's editing and stops here or there or whatever.
Were you able to point those things out, though, during the testimony of any of the witnesses?
Are you speaking, Justice, at the trial?
At the trial. And bring that, so your same arguments that you're raising here today, were you able to raise those in the form of cross-examination or so forth so that the jury understood that they could be questioned?
Yes, we were afforded that opportunity. I must admit that at the point where Mr. Schnell was testifying, I was able to ask him questions on cross-examination as to the amount of contacts he had with this particular family, which was somewhere in the neighborhood of 73 to 90 over the three-year period. And of course, there was no video evidence that was presented by Mr. Schnell or any other defense witness suggesting that showing Mr. Daniels exhibiting pain or having any residual problems as a result of his activities on the job or otherwise.
Your client had testified at the deposition that he, quote, couldn't really work above his head in August of 1998, and then he, when questioned about pinstriping a vehicle, he said he used a ladder so he could work below the shoulder level, and these videotapes showed the opposite, didn't they?
That is true, Justice Erickson, but the unfairness, we believe, is that he did say those things, but he also, if one looks at the testimony taken from his deposition transcript back in 2001, which Mr. Kappelman had repeatedly referred to, he qualified all of those statements and said, I'm not saying that I could not do that. I'm just saying that it was difficult for me, and I tried to get other people to do that for me.
But you had an opportunity to argue that to the jury, so isn't that a jury issue for a finding of fact?
I believe it could be. I am suggesting to the court at this point that a jury seeing visual depictions of my client working overhead and having the innuendo and representations by defense counsel that he could not, created a prejudice that we could not unring. And even though we did present the argument in that fashion, and we did cross-examine Mr. Schnell that he never took any other video other than those 42 minutes over all those years, we still feel that the introduction of that was against the rules of evidence in that it was exhibited purely for purposes of showing passion and prejudice and to inflame the jury. Their own expert on the medical side, Dr. Halberstein, had admitted that my client was not a malingerer. And yet this evidence was presented in the face of that to suggest that he was. And so we used our abilities with what we had, since the court denied our motion in limine to keep these out, to try to deal with that passion and prejudice that we believe overwhelmed this jury when they saw those videos. I believe that that is not a fair application of that type of evidence under these circumstances. I picture it akin to a double negative, that you say essentially where an individual is accused of doing something and he's asked to prove that he basically he doesn't have proof to show that he didn't, so therefore he must be guilty.
Now remind me again on these, on the videos. Originally you filed a motion in limine.
Yes.
And do you know if the trial court had had an opportunity to see the videos at the time you did the motion in limine?
I was searching the record best I could, Justice Meyer-Henry, for that. I cannot represent to this court whether Judge Davis actually viewed those. I know that he always, our practice in the Seventh Circuit is that when we present evidence as a trial exhibit, we assume that he does. So I'm
assuming then he did, and this was prior to any of the evidence coming in. Did you renew that objection then at the time that they were actually introduced into evidence during the trial?
I did.
Okay, and at that time, did you argue the prejudice and passion to the court?
I believe the renewal of the objection was, I can't quote it verbatim, but it was in the sense of, Your Honor, I would like to renew my objection on the previous arguments that I raised in the motion in limine, and I didn't go into any specific detail other than that.
So we would normally review a trial court's decision on evidence on an abuse of discretion. What are you saying is, what would we have to say as far as what the abuse of discretion is in this case?
I would say that Judge Davis erred in possibly not reviewing these tapes. Again, I don't know if he actually did. I can't represent to the court whether he did or not, but we assume that he did. And that there was clearly indication in our argument in the record that Mr. Daniels had said basically that he was not, or excuse me, he had indicated that he could not do these things, and yet it was suggested that he was indicating that it was impossible for him to do these things. So essentially, the evidence that was presented in the form of these tapes had the purpose and the motive to exhibit Mr. Daniels in a manner in which we feel was unfair, because we could not present testimony in contradiction of that, other than the fact that he said that he could do these things. And so it created confusion and an opportunity for passion and prejudice to inflame this jury.
You know, in order to preserve your motion for directed verdict for appeal, you're supposed to make you're supposed to renew that motion at the close of all evidence. And at page 13 in your brief, you say you did that, but you don't cite us to a trial record. And I don't see it in the trial record. The record indicates that the jury was excused and you went right to settlement of instructions. And is that what happened?
Justice Erickson, when I saw Mr. Kaplan's brief in response to the appellate's brief, I went back and I checked our record from my handwritten notes and from everything that was recorded on the transcript. And I believe he is correct that it was not renewed. And if, in fact, the state of the law suggests that our directed or motion for directed verdict was not appropriately made, I guess then that's the state of the law.
Okay. You've used up three-fourths of your time, so let's get to the heart of the case then.
Justice Sabers, we also have an issue which was dealt with on the matter of the defendant's motion, which was defendant's motion in limine number 4, which is exhibit 3. I believe that this is an extremely dangerous motion. I believe it's a highly prejudicial motion. This is something that our colleagues in the law on both sides of the fence representing individuals throughout the state need to be concerned about. The genesis of how this motion in limine was made, I should share with the court. I believe that we briefed it, but I think it's important to understand how this came to be.
Are you talking now about issue 3?
Issue 3.
And that was the order you weren't to cry in front of the jury, is that right?
Yes. It was a motion filed by the defense to keep trial counsel, namely myself, from crying in front of the jury during the trial, particularly at points in opening and closing. The written order that was made a part of this case actually states nothing about giving leeway on that. It makes it very specific that it would be a violation for any showing of emotion to lead to crying. The reason that this is dangerous, and my brothers and sisters in the plaintiff's bar as well as the defense bar, I believe, are concerned enough that they are watching this issue with keen eyes. My training with Mr. Spence's Trial Lawyers College, I'm very proud of. I think it is something that has enlightened me, not just as a trial lawyer, but as a human being. I presented this in my motion to reconsider the judge's ruling on that particular motion in limine, and those arguments are specifically set out therein. However, justices, when we are in court, particularly in a trial, I think a trial is basically a mini microcosm of life. And many things that happen in a trial, I know that all of you justices have had the experience of countless civil trials under your belts, and so you can have the experience and know what that feels like. But in the heat of battle, in the pursuit of justice, whoever side you're on, whether you're defending, you're plaintiffing, what have you, we're dealing with human beings, human responses, and human emotions.
Where in the trial record did you point out to Judge Davis how your presentation was weakened by this particular order?
I don't believe that there ever was any particular point, Justice Erickson, in the trial where I specifically went up to the judge or the bench and said, I'm about to cry now. I can't. I want to overrule the motion in limine. I don't believe that ever happened.
Did you point out anywhere where this, how this prejudices you or your client in your presentation?
Well, that was all done before. My practice as a trial attorney is that when a motion in limine is in place, you're supposed to take that very seriously and use that as the law of the case. And I think that for me to tread over that line and purposely violate a motion in limine would have created a possible mistrial for my client, would not have served justice. Although there are points in time where emotion can reach a point where you feel that you may shed a tear or become motivated and overcome by the moment, the storytelling of what has to happen in the trial many times brings forth the soul, and the soul brings forth the emotion.
And I don't disagree with that, but what I'm trying to figure out is, in this particular case, under these particular circumstances, what didn't you do that you wanted to do? And when was that pointed out to the judge?
Again, I'm hard-pressed to find anything in the record during the trial where I specifically stated anything to Judge Davis in particular. However, it had a chilling effect on myself throughout the entire trial that it was a matter of, I felt, an attack upon the manner of preparation, strategy, and ability to represent my client to the best of my ability.
Have you answered just Judge Erickson's question?
I think so.
Okay, thank you. Your time is up. Mr. Kappelman?
Good morning, Justices. May it please the court, counsel.
Can I just start with the, from where we left off here with this motion in limine? What on earth prompted you to bring a motion in limine of this effect that the other side couldn't show emotion? I mean, doesn't that really, I mean, seriously, doesn't that open kind of a slippery slope here that you're tying the hands of a trial attorney and trying a case? It's the jury that needs to decide whether what the verdict is, and the court, as I recall, you know, I've always, and I think every trial court in this state tells the jury they can't decide on based on prejudice or passion. So as long as the trial court instructs the jury on that, what's the harm here, and why should we condone this kind of a motion in limine?
Well, Your Honor, I'm glad you asked that. I've been practicing now for 30 years, and I haven't sat down and numbered the jury trials I've had, but I think it's somewhere between 50 and 75 jury trials. Only two times in my whole practice has the opposite lawyer ever broken down and cried in their closing statements in front of the jury. Those two lawyers are people who have gone to this Jerry Spence School of Trial Tactics. I don't think there's no doubt in my mind that this is what they're taught to do. Why would it be so unusual that only two of them has happened to me? That's happened to me twice. Both these people have gone to this school. Now,
what's the harm in that as opposed to the other side? Does that mean then that you're opening this whole motion in limine that says, all right, defense counsel now can't raise their voice and rant and rave that this has no basis? I mean, where do you draw the line here on emotions? Because trials are, a lot of times the lawyers, I mean, in the heat of a trial, get very emotional one way or the other, angry, happy, sad, whatever it might be.
And Your Honor, I don't disagree with you at all, and that is why I think it's important to find what did Judge Davis say in the record. And I've cited on page 20 and page 21 in my brief exactly the state of the record on this. Judge Davis basically said, Mr. Zephyr, I am not precluding you from showing emotion in this trial. That is not what I'm doing. I'm precluding you from having a staged production and contriving a crying incident in front of this jury for the sole purpose of eliciting sympathy from the jury.
How does the trial judge make that determination between true emotion and contrived emotion?
I suppose I guess I'm not sure how the judge is going to make that determination, Your Honor.
Isn't that the slippery slope that Justice Meyer Henry mentioned? I mean, that's the dilemma you create for the court?
Well, I certainly wasn't trying to create a dilemma for the court. What I was trying to do is stop what has happened to me twice before from people who've gone to this school who, in an effort, in a very simple effort, to get sympathy from the jury and more damages for their client, summon up enough emotion to begin to cry. Now, I don't think it's, I guess I don't see that as a big problem for them not to cry in front of the jury in a deliberate attempt to get damages from the jury. I don't think that's acceptable, and I think that the trial court has, according to your decisions, has wide discretion of how to run his courtroom, and he can certainly say to the either counsel, that's not acceptable in my courtroom. You can show emotion, you just can't deliberately cry in front of the jury and have a staged production.
Aren't there better ways to handle that, though, than a motion in limine? I mean, don't we have canons of professional ethics? We've got you can make proper objections. You can ask if you feel it's contrived. You can ask for a hearing outside the presence of the jury and instruct the jury. I mean, we have people cry in court all the time.
Witnesses. I've certainly seen lots of witnesses cry, Your Honor. I would agree with you. But it's
isn't
not
that more damning than to your case than a lawyer crying?
Well, I can't. I don't think I can control, nor would I expect that the trial judge would control a witness cry, deliberately cry. But what I guess in answer to your question, Your Honor, it seems to me that I'm in a pretty bad position if I have to sit there and wait until he starts to do that, and then I jump up and object, or I make a motion at the close of all at the trial to say that it was deliberate and it had some impact upon the jury. I felt that I needed to do it on the front end of the case rather than wait until the damage is already done and then try to mend the damage. I mean, this I can say, Your Honor, in all honesty, the two times that it's happened to me, it had a big effect upon the jury. These people stood up there and cried crocodile tears. And what am I supposed to do? I mean, I suppose I could jump up and object. I think it'd be bad form. I think that the jury might think not very much of me at that particular point. So I just felt like I told myself that the next time I had a case with someone who I knew attended those schools quite regularly, I was going to make this motion because I just couldn't stand to see it happen to me again. It was very prejudicial to my clients in the two times that it's happened to me.
How do you know that this Jerry Spence school instructs people to cry crocodile tears? I mean, you haven't been to it, have you?
No, I'm not allowed to go to it. I do too much defense work to go to it. I checked into that. But the reason I know it is because only two lawyers and all these years have done it, and they are the two lawyers that have gone to the school and now teach over at the school. So that's how I know it, Your Honor. I don't guess could I, you know, swear to it absolutely under oath. No, I haven't been there, but it certainly seems suspicious to me that that's the people who've done it and the only people who've done it. And I don't think that it's an imposition for the trial court to tell either side, either lawyer, that fine if you want to show all the motion you can, but I just and really, yeah, Judge Davis even said, I understand if it happened and it's a genuine emotion and a result of whatever, it ain't no big deal. We just aren't going to have a contrived situation. And he went on and he said, we're not going to have a staged production. That's what he was saying. And I think that the trial judge, according to the law in this state, has that control over the lawyers and properly exercised his discretion in this case.
How many motions in limine did you file?
Probably four, Your Honor. I mean, the standard one on insurance, and I think I filed a motion in limine probably on payment of damages for the vehicle. This was an admitted liability case.
Okay. I have another question on the jumping to another issue on the $10,000 verdict. What do you point to in the evidence that supports that $10,000 verdict?
Lots of stuff, Your Honor. This particular man, in fact, what I did is I quite carefully went through the record of the trial, starting on page 10 of my brief and going through, page 13. But to sum it up, Travis Daniels had neck problems for at least 8 years before this accident. He had neck problems for at least 5 years before this accident. We had all sorts of medical records that showed that this man had repeated visits to doctors from 1990 through 1998, the time of the accident. There wasn't any doubt that he had prior neck problems and prior shoulder problems well before this accident. We also showed the jury that when he went to the emergency room right after the accident, he had no pain whatsoever anywhere. Even though the doctor palpated him and did everything he could possibly do, he had no pain whatsoever. Now, even the plaintiff's expert testified that if you tear the labrum in your shoulder, which Travis Daniels contended that he did in this accident, you should have immediate pain. And that makes sense. And Dr. Hoverston said the same thing, the defense expert. Now, this man goes into the emergency room and has no pain whatsoever. Then the documents show that he has no documented right shoulder pain for 5 months after the accident. He makes 80 visits to his chiropractor, Dr. Gorsuch, before he finally mentions that he has right shoulder pain. So we think that the record was very clear that the man did not get that seriously injured in this accident. He got rear-ended. We admitted liability. We believe that the evidence showed quite clearly he had no significant injury that he could tie to this accident. At the time of the trial, Mr. Daniels acknowledged what I had done is I'd taken a second deposition. It'd been so long from the first deposition, and the trial was coming up, I took a second. That ended up to be 10 months before the trial. Well, 10 months before the trial, he said he was only having neck pain, if he had it, once every other month, or once a month, or once or every other month. Well, he was having that sort of pain 8 years before the accident. I'm trying to go through here. He had shoulder surgery. His doctor testified about what a great result that was. He kept saying that he had no pain following that shoulder surgery. Basically, he wasn't seriously hurt in the accident, and we believe that easily justifies this particular verdict of $10,000.
Now, you made an offer of judgment initially in the amount of $50,000. And then you upped that to an offer of judgment in the amount of $75,000. And I don't know if we should take judicial notice of the fact that you don't tend to do that unless there's some merit to the case. And then we end up with a verdict for $10,000. Isn't that kind of a clear showing that the verdict was arrived at out of passion and prejudice and ought to be result in a new trial?
No, Your Honor. I certainly can't say. I've never seen that in any cases. I've never heard that made before. Offers of judgment are made based upon what you know at the time. We made an early offer of judgment. We made a second offer of judgment. But I do not believe that that in any way shows that somehow that the verdict is suspect just because we made an offer of judgment. I mean, that's done all the time where you make an offer of judgment and the verdict comes in less than the offer of judgment. And I certainly wouldn't concede that at all, Your Honor. But what I would like to speak about, make sure I have enough time to speak about, is this business of our contention that the defendant should receive a judgment for his costs and expenditures in this case in the sum of $6,068.40. I mean, as you point out, we made an offer of judgment on October 1, 2001 for $50,000 plus costs. And the judgment of the jury, the verdict came back at $10,000. And under 15668, Daniels has to pay the defendant's costs and expenditures from and after the time of that offer of judgment of October 1, 2001. And this case is factually indistinguishable from the Zahn case. Absolutely. I mean, and in the Zahn case, you'll recall that there was an offer for, first offer was for $6,000, second offer was for $10,000, verdict was for $3,000. And this court said, and I'll quote, SDCL 15668 allows a party who makes an offer of judgment to recover costs incurred after the making of the offer if the judgment is not more favorable than the rejected offer. I mean, I believe that if you study that Zahn case and you see what happened in this particular case, they are factually indistinguishable as far as the offer of judgment is concerned.
Mr. Gavelman, I couldn't see Judge Davis's reasoning for denying that request. Can you enlighten us?
Well,
what the thinking was with regard to that?
I can say this, Your Honor. First of all, he did grant those costs. In a first order, he granted those costs. Let's see if I have that as an exhibit here to... maybe not. I think Mr. Zephyr attached it as an exhibit to his brief. But he did, first of all, grant those costs from and after October 1, 2001 forward. Now... then he later, in answer to your question, I believe the only thing he said was, I think Daniels was the prevailing party. Therefore, I'm not going to give Kettering costs. That's what the order says, which is Exhibit 1 to my, it's called Amended Order Regarding Taxation of Costs. It's Exhibit 1 to my brief. And he said the defendant is not entitled to costs because the plaintiff was the prevailing party.
Prevailing party analysis applies to disbursements, not offers of judgment.
I understand.
Was there some confusion?
Well, I guess I think there was some confusion, Your Honor. I think that it's clear under the Zahn case that we should have gotten our costs and disbursements. I don't think there's any question about it. I would also point out that there's another interesting twist to that particular argument. As the court is aware, if Mr. Zephyr is going to object to my claim for costs, he has to come in and object within 10 days of my application. The record is quite clear about this. He did not come in and make a timely objection to our costs. And we think that for that reason, that the court should award Defendant Kettering his costs of $6,068.48. Number one, because of the Zahn case. Number two, because Mr. Zephyr didn't even make a timely application, timely objection to our application for costs. I see I have a little time left. If you have no other questions, I want to make sure that I covered that last point adequately.
I have one thing. What were the specials that were submitted to the jury here?
He had $21,000-some-odd in medical bills, Your Honor. Let me get the exact number for you. Well, I'm not turning to it right now. It was $21,000-some-odd in medical bills that he claimed resulted from the accident. And you'll recall, we made an offer, or we admitted liability on this particular case, but we admitted negligence simply. We did not admit that his alleged damages or injuries were approximately caused by this accident. And as I went through with Justice Meyer Henry, I think the record is quite clear about what was going on with Travis Daniels in the 8 years prior to this accident, as well as what happened to him subsequent to the accident, such that the $10,000 verdict was entirely appropriate, and I think the jury saw that. There was some discussion here about those videotapes. I mean, those videotapes, as Justice Erickson pointed out, clearly showed that Travis Daniels was not being honest when he gave the deposition to me on June 5th, 2001. I mean, he said, I asked him, could you work above your shoulders in August 1998, that's 4 months after the accident? And he said, not really. So we showed the jury probably about 20-some minutes of videotape with him repeatedly working clear up here above his shoulders with both hands. I mean, there's no doubt about the fact that he was lying about that. There was also this business about, well, when you're, if you say you can't work with your right hand above your shoulder level, what about if you're pinstriping a trailer, what would you do? And he said, well, you know, I would get up on a ladder so I could work down here below shoulder level. So we were able to show the jury through a videotape that he pinstriped a whole horse trailer, what, by working just at that same level up here, and there's a ladder in the videotape that he's not utilizing whatsoever. That's another circumstance, obviously, that I think the jury could see that this man was not being honest with them. He was not being straightforward with his claim. He wouldn't even admit all these prior problems that he had, that the medical records quite clearly showed that he had prior neck pain and prior shoulder problems for years. He wouldn't admit that. He even went so far as to say, during the course of the trial, after his shoulder surgery, he had gone in and visited with a Dr. Fromm, an orthopedic surgeon. And Dr. Fromm would report how he was doing. And most of the time it was, he's doing very well. He's doing great. Things are good. Travis Daniels took the position that he actually told Dr. Fromm that he was having pain, but Dr. Fromm wrote something different in the records, i.e. he wasn't having any pain. So he took that position in front of the jury. So I guess when you ask Justice Meyer Henry, how can we justify this $10,000 verdict, I think it was quite easy to justify the verdict in light of the record, and the record's quite clear about all the inconsistencies there were in this man's testimony.
So part of those medical bills were other than the immediate injuries or treatment at the time he was injured.
Right.
Medical bills.
Absolutely. He went to the emergency room of the Rapid City Regional Hospital. Then he subsequently went to a chiropractor. Then he subsequently went to an orthopedic surgeon. And he eventually had a shoulder surgery. He accumulated $21,000 worth of medical bills, but the jury didn't think they were related to this accident.
Okay, your time's up.
Thank you.
Justice, if I could, I want to clarify something. I apologize to the court, but I must express that I was offended by the motion in limine concerning the matter of crying in front of the jury. I have never in all of my years of practice concocted any type of a matter in front of a court of law or in front of a jury. And this lacked foundation. It's basically an accusatory.
But how did it harm you then? You've never done it before. How did it harm you? You weren't intending on crying, contrived crying in this case, were you?
No, absolutely not.
So how did it prejudice you anymore?
I believe it created a chilling effect on my ability to tell his story. Many times.
But it doesn't even go to that. I mean, you can tell the story. You can express emotion. You can be mad, you can be angry. The only thing you can't do is contrived crying.
Well, again, I was always mindful of what would happen if I did cry. Who's going to make a determination whether I was, as Mr. Kappelman suggests, he would have surely argued that I was crocodile tears.
But you could argue the other side, that it was, that it came from your soul, it came from your heart, it came from the facts of the case.
It always does, Justice, and absolutely, right. I would
so
argue that.
So then, how were you prejudiced? How was your client prejudiced in the result of, in this case, as a result of that order?
Well, I believe that sometimes when the jury can see the camaraderie, the ability to communicate between lawyer and client in front of their very eyes, they can envision a perception of trust. And trust is key many times in credibility issues. And I think that more than anything cognizant of what this motion in limine was hanging over our head with, created that type of an environment. It was almost like an invisible black cloud that I couldn't tell the jury about. But Justice Sabers, I would like to share with you all that one of the instances that Mr. Kappelman was referring to, where lawyers that had trained with the Jerry Spence Trial Lawyers College had been the only two in his career who he had noticed crying in front of the jury. Actually, he and I were trying a case 3 or 4 years ago, but we were on the same side. My client had a counterclaim against her as a plaintiff, and Mr. Kappelman was defending my client as well. So in that case, I must admit I did get overwhelmed at one point in closing argument, and there were real tears that were shed, but it was Mr. Kappelman was on our side on that case as well. I think the matter of the slippery slope is of extreme importance, not just to lawyers, but to judges. The Trial Lawyers College is a manner that was established many, many years ago, and it now encompasses training for not just lawyers for through the United States and other countries, but also judges. And the key training is basically to allow the individual to become themselves in the human sense. It's not a training or a college to try to let you know tricks to trick people or to create false scenarios. It's exactly the opposite.
Well, but you know, Mr. Zipfer, that's not the point here. It seems to me that what you're asking us to do is to write an opinion that says a trial court does not have the authority or discretion to control contrived concoctions in the courtroom. And I don't know how we could possibly write such a decision that says a trial court doesn't have the authority to control their courtroom in this manner.
Justice Zinter, I totally agree with you. I understand your predicament on this court. I would make a suggestion, however, and that is that the use of a motion in limine as a prohibitive preventative device in this particular case, I believe, was the inappropriate vehicle. The showing of emotion, I believe, is unavoidable. I would say that most lawyers in our state, or anywhere else for that matter, are bound by the rules of ethics, the canons, our local circuit rules, things that have control. Our trial judges, we become accustomed to them every time we try a case in front of them. It's a given that a judge has the ability to control what happens in his courtroom. That's a given. We're not asking you to fashion an opinion that would challenge that. What we're asking you to do is look at how this occurred and how the use of a motion in limine was used as a prior restraint, a prohibition in a sense. And these other vehicles that are available to lawyers would be just as effective. I'm talking about the objection on the moment, the sanctions, motion for new trial, motion for directed verdict, argument before the jury. Those are mechanisms that don't have the chilling, prohibitive effect of this particular vehicle. And that's what I'm suggesting, Justice, is that I'm not asking this court to wipe aside rules of law and to say that a judge can't do what she can do in the courtroom. By all means, I think the representations that was made by Judge Davis to myself, I think Judge Davis and I have a common respect. I know that that's developed over the years. But he was reacting to information from Mr. Kappelman with no foundation except Mr. Kappelman's beliefs. That's the dangerousness of what this is. And that's a dangerous, not just to the legal community, but also to any judicial participants, whether they be innocent victims of crime, innocent accused, or civil litigants on both sides of the fence. And so what we're suggesting is that an honest eye be seen to look at how this happened. And this is that slippery slope that we always talk about. If the emotion of crying were prohibited in such a manner and condoned by use of emotion and limiting. What about laughing? What about anger? What about snideness, pettiness? As I stated before, trials are many microcosm of life. We're flawed beings. We're capable of mistakes. We're capable of being less than perfect. And a trial judge has to have the ability to control, absolutely. However, I think this overstepped the bounds. With that said, Justices, I didn't have anything further I would like to say before the court. However, if you do have any other questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
Well, as Chief Justice Gilbertson frequently says, nobody ever gets punished for putting before the time's up. So, thank you.
Chief Justice Gilbertson, I'd like to offer my personal gratitude to you taking the time out to hear this over the phone.
Welcome.
Thank you, brothers.
We'll be adjourned till 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.